and in the Atlantic, teams were needed on the beaches of France to blow open the gateway to Europe for D-Day. The Allies would have to land somewhere along the coast of France. They knew that Hitler had built a massive Atlantic wall to prevent the invasion and that they would have to find a way to breach it. But on the eve of its entry into World War II, the U.S. military had no one with expertise in this kind of complex demolition work. The U.S. Navy would recruit a 31-year-old expatriate, Draper Kaufman. He would help create one of the forefather teams of today's Navy SEALs. When the nearsighted Kaufman graduated from the Naval Academy, he failed to get a commission in the U.S. Navy. But by the late 1930s, France and England were at war with Germany, years before America entered the fray. So he went overseas to serve, becoming an ambulance driver. After a brief stint as a German prisoner of war, he went to London to join the fight there. Kaufman's experience with ordnance got him a transfer from the British Navy to the American one. His orders to start the U.S. Navy's bomb disposal unit came just in the nick of time. Shortly after the Japanese attack on Hawaii, Kaufman was ordered to dismantle an unexploded 500-pound bomb in Pearl Harbor. For his valor, he was awarded the Navy Cross. He returned to Washington, D.C. to run the Navy's bomb disposal school. Then, in 1943, while on his honeymoon, Lieutenant Commander Kaufman received orders to report back to D.C.
After 4 days of honeymoon, we were at the Hotel New Yorker, and I got a telegram telling me to report immediately, and I did what I guess anybody else would have done. I gave the young bellboy $5 and said, "Son, you can't find me. Come back tomorrow."
When he arrived in Washington, Draper Kaufman was given his new assignment, clear Hitler's beaches.
"Have you ever seen intelligence pictures of the obstacles the Germans are building on their beaches in France?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Well, they're putting obstacles out in 6 feet of water that would stop the landing craft there, and the soldiers would have to get out in 6 feet of water. Do you know how much an infantryman's pack weighs?" And I said, "No, sir." He said, "Well, neither do I, but they'll all drown." He said, "Now, I want you to put a stop to that."
Kaufman's new mission took him from running a school on disposing unexploded bombs to exploding ones. He was ordered to create the Naval Combat Demolition Units, or NCDU.
GlobalRecon.net, giving you the matter of facts. Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. As most of you know, I'm sure, in the past 24 hours has been pretty hectic globally. To start with, the Russian ambassador to Turkey was assassinated in Turkey by a Turkish police officer. The ambassador's name is Andrei Karlov, and he was shot in the back at an art gallery by a Turkish police officer while he was giving a speech to the Turkish media. The entire thing was captured on camera. It's pretty shocking. And the guy was saying something to the effect of, after he shot the ambassador and the ambassador was on the ground, he was yelling with his pistol in his hand, and he was making some political statements in relation to Syria and specifically Aleppo, the situation going on there. And it was, you know, pretty crazy. And then shortly afterwards in Berlin, and someone drove a truck into a crowd of people at a Christmas market, killing over 10 people, wounding over 50, I believe. So, you know, a lot has been going on. Obviously, these things just happened, so all the details aren't available as investigations are underway. I know yesterday on Facebook, after the ambassador was assassinated, a lot of people were trying to make comparisons to the beginning of the First World War. But, you know, immediately my first reaction wasn't that Russia and Turkey were going to go to war. I feel like Russia, not that they couldn't win a war against Turkey, but that they, it's not in their, I guess, national goals. Like they don't, because if they go to war in Turkey and they destabilize Turkey, that entire region will just go up in smoke. I mean, there's already a lot going on with ISIS in Iraq and, you know, the war in Syria. So a war in Turkey would really throw the entire place into chaos. And that is something that I believe the Russians do not want. I believe they want to have a small footprint in the region. And as reports are coming out, it's looking like they're calling this a terrorist attack. And Turkey and the Russians are cooperating to try and figure out what happened. So in terms of that, you know, I don't think things are going to happen, as, you know, people were saying, kind of, you know, a larger war is going to break out. No, I definitely don't think so. So with that being said, for today's podcast, I had a interview with an active duty Navy EOD technician. His name is Damien. We'll get into that in a second. Damien's had an interesting career with a few rotations, and Damien spoke about, you know, what led him into the military, some of his experiences throughout it, and then he gave us a combat story, one of his deployment stories. But, you know, what I wanted to note and was interesting about the conversation with Damien is there was a point where we were talking about some of his fallen brothers, and a point that he wanted to make very clear was that he isn't doing this for himself. He's doing it to honor and recognize his brothers. And I think that's very important for the audience to take away. So, you know, before we get into that, I just want to announce that starting in the new year, we're going to start releasing articles on a regular basis. We're putting together a pretty solid team of writers from various backgrounds and various experiences. So from now till perhaps mid-January or beginning of February, we'll release some articles just to kind of give you guys a taste of what's what to expect. But it wouldn't get into full throttle until about February. So, you know, be on the lookout for that. We may revamp the website and get some other things going, some interesting projects rolling. So with that being said, now I'll play the conversation that I had with Damien, the Navy EOD technician. Hey, what's going on, guys? On with me for this week's podcast is Damien, and Damien is a Navy EOD technician. Damien, how's it going, brother?
Good. What's going on, man? Thanks for having me.
No, not much, man. Thanks for coming on. So on the podcast, you know, previously, maybe a couple of months back, I had an Army EOD tech, and we spoke about, you know, some of his time in Afghanistan and stuff like that. And, you know, obviously the Navy EOD component is very active in, you know, fighting today's wars and stuff like that. And it's a very important role that you guys play because of the, you know, IED threat that's faced in Afghanistan, Iraq, and, you know, anywhere where we are combating terrorism. So, you know, we'll talk about some of that. But before we get into any of that, can we talk about what motivated you to join the Navy?
Yeah, sure. So I had dropped out of college for the third time. And my last semester, and I had moved to New York City in 1999. And I was living in Brooklyn when the attacks happened on September 11th. So being in the city, you know, watching that happen, being there for the aftermath of that. I was 27 when the attacks happened, and I thought I was like, well, I'm still young enough. Like, my grandfather had served in World War II, and he was a POW in World War II, and then my uncles had been in Vietnam, and I had never really, I mean, I'd thought about the military, but you know, that was what really spurned me. And I said, well, I need to do something. It seems silly to not help or do something. So then I started thinking about that process, and I really wanted to join the Army. I really wanted to join the Army. And my wife at the time, she said she wanted to live on the water. So I said, okay, I guess I'll join the Navy then. So that was it. And then I joined in 2003.
Okay, so when you joined up, you didn't go straight into the EOD realm, right?
No, I did. I didn't do that. And then when I was in A school to be a machinist, man, I was like, well, maybe I'll do it. And then I ended up going to dive school, and I ended up dropping. I actually wanted to get out of the military, the Navy completely. And I dropped out, and I was just going to finish my time as a mechanic and then just get out and switch over to the Army. And then, I did 2 years on a ship, and during that time I had friends that had been over there. And, you know, the EOD, the job changed a lot while we were in Iraq, I think. I mean, I can't speak for the people before that, but it seemed that the job as a Navy EOD tech had kind of, or as all EOD techs, as the EOD tech job in general, changed a lot with the IED threat. And then I said, you know, maybe this will be good. And then I decided to go back, and then I finished and I went back, and then in 08, I graduated EOD school.
So when you say change, do you mean in terms of like the kind of the importance of the role of the EOD technician, or?
Well, I think it just changed. I think the mission, the mentality maybe. I don't know, because I can't speak about what it was before. It seemed like, oh, this is – it just seemed different. Like, oh, these IEDs are – this is a big deal, and I don't see it going away, and this could be important. This could be it interested me. So I decided to stay and give it a shot.
Yeah, and it's you know, I know before you know, before Iraq, Afghanistan, there were, you know, obviously we had that capacity to deal with right. such threats, but the threat level of these improvised explosive devices has reached like unprecedented levels, and I believe it's the number one killer of American servicemen in Afghanistan and Iraq, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they suck. Yeah, I mean, it's there's no way they're going away. It's way too successful. It's way too easy, you know. So
right, and it's like they, you know, it's easy to put these devices together. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, and one thing that's kind of interesting that I think a lot of people in the Western world tend to get wrong a lot is, you know, when you're talking about, let's say, Iraq, for example, or Afghanistan as well, not everyone that's fighting against the U.S. or taking part in the fight is in it for the ideological reasons that they opposed, you know, the West or that kind of thing. But in a lot of cases, it's, you know, the Taliban or whoever it is that guys might be fighting in a specific area. They say, hey, look, we'll pay you X amount of dollars if you go and plant this this bomb on the side of the road. And when, you know, a U.S. truck drives over it, you know, press the button and explode this munition. And it really gets to the point where in a lot of cases, it's like a financial thing. You know, it's economic, and it makes sense for the guy who's getting involved in it to do it because he's getting paid and he has really no other way to do it. Or in this situation where it's like, you either work for us or we're going to kill you kind of thing, you know? And a lot of people who don't pay attention to these things wouldn't know that, you know? And it's kind of unfortunate for everybody involved.
Yeah. And there's very little threat to someone in placing an IED. Unless you're caught placing the ID, it's not like you're engaging us in a firefight or not. We're not getting, you know, it's not like getting a tick, you know. You can leave the scene and it's done. You know, if we step on it or we don't, it's still there and it doesn't really cause the enemy any risk. Or if it's a, you know, RCID or, you know, their command wire or whatever, however they're initiated. You know, it's a much smaller threat to them than it is engaging us in a firefight.
Right. Right. So, yeah. Okay. So you say you graduated EOD school in what, 08?
Yeah.
And is that like a long process, going through the whole selection and
yeah, what was it? Yeah, I think I started in January of 07 school, like dive prep up in Great Lakes. And then you go to dive school in Panama City and then EOD school and then jump school. We went to jump school at Fort Benning. It's even different now. They have like expeditionary, I think, comp or something in Mississippi after that now. But we did all of our like post training in San Diego. Like our helo training, you know, rappelling and fast roping, weapons, comms, all that stuff is in San Diego. So, yeah, I think it took about, I had a little setback. I got like MRSA in the last division and I had to wait, but I think all the way through, it's about 12 months. If you make it all the way through.
Oh, so that's a decent amount of time.
Yeah.
So the EODs is interesting, especially Navy EOD. It's not, I don't think it's, you guys fall under a special operations command necessarily.
No, not at all.
Okay. So even though you don't, you guys are highly trained and have a, you know, very unique specialty mm-hmm. and all of your rotations are attached to a special operations unit, if I'm not mistaken.
No. We have different mission sets. So we can be attached to special operations units, but we can be like, I did a deployment where I was initially attached to an infantry unit. You know, I was attached to an army infantry unit. You know, in Iraq, they did route clearance. They did response. We did that in Afghanistan, just, you know, response teams that you get IED calls and you just go out and you take care of those IEDs. Those aren't attached to special operations units. But yeah, we do get attached to Army Special Forces and SEAL teams as well.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting, you know, because it's a specialized, you know, it's a specialty, it's, but it isn't considered special ops, but you guys can work right. with, so it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a good variety. You get a good variety in that way.
And when you go through the dive portion, you guys are also working with, you know, using your skill sets and your mission set to render explosives underwater useless as well. Is that part of it?
That is part of it. In theory, yeah, that would be. It's possible. Yeah, it's very sketchy underwater, but yeah, we're trained to do that too. Yeah.
Right. Cool. Yeah. So now you have a few rotations that were all into Afghanistan?
So my first rotation, I was on an underwater kind of a mine countermeasure team, and that was to Bahrain. And we just did kind of like training exercises out of Bahrain and other countries. And then the next three deployments were all in Afghanistan. Yeah.
Okay. And so now in Afghanistan is interesting for several reasons, but one of them is that, if I'm not mistaken, I believe Afghanistan is the most mined country on the planet, and so obviously yeah. that's a place where, you know, EOD's skills are needed. And what's kind of interesting about Afghanistan is that not only are there a ton of mines and IEDs from, you know, the Taliban and, you know, Haqqani Network and all these kind of different groups that are fighting, but also from the time that the Russians were in Afghanistan.
Right.
And,
there's a lot of landmines. Yeah.
Right. And I think when the Russians left, you know, they left something like, you know, somewhere in the millions of mines, you know, like in the country.
Yes. Yes. Well, there's a lot of them.
And
very similar to Southeast Asia, you know. I mean, that Southeast Asia also is littered with landmines from the wars there too.
Right, like Laos and Cambodia. And,
yeah, all those. Yeah,
yeah. I was watching a like a short clip of a documentary, And it was talking about this organization. I think they were Danish, and they basically go into different countries and help with the demining process.
Yeah, humanitarian demining. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, it's crazy because a lot of the times, and even like in I think it was Laos or Cambodia. I'm not sure which one, but you know, the U.S. was dropping a lot of bombs on these areas, and in some cases, these bombs wouldn't explode right away.
Right.
And, you know, villagers or, you know, whatever, the local people there are, like, going about their daily business, and someone steps on a landmine, and they, you know, they blow their leg off. And
right.
It's really unfortunate. So do you guys also, like, for the EOD techs, mm-hmm. do you guys have like different specialties within the teams, or is it just kind of everyone has the similar skill training?
No. Yeah. So it's not like kind of how ODAs are broken up or stuff like that, how they have different specialties, even though they cross train too from the guys that I worked with. But no, we generally all train to the same level. We have different levels of like EOD tech. We have a basic tech, you know, senior EOD tech, then master EOD tech. But as far as that, we're all trained to do the same thing. Because you'll have an EOD platoon, right? Say you have 10, like, and I'll use it, like for instance, with an NSW platoon. And two EOD tech, like a two-man team, they will go with each separate SEAL platoon. So two EOD techs will support one SEAL platoon within the troop and all that. So a lot of times you're working in two-man teams or three-man teams or, you know, maybe four-man teams, but you will end up splitting up out of that platoon. Yeah.
So in the way it's set up, like an EOD, like you would never deploy with a team of EOD techs, right? You kind of get shotgunned out to where you're needed.
You'll deploy together, and then you may get sent out. You know, you either may get attached to like a platoon or an ODA, or you may go somewhere kind of, for lack of a better term, like base out of one spot and kind of get farmed out as needed. It just depends on what you're deploying for and who you're supporting.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I know, I think it was what's the name of the movie? The Hurt Locker.
yeah.
After the Hurt Locker came out, that kind of like, brought some attention to the role. Mm-hmm. Now, how was that movie received? Like, did guys think it was a good movie? Or?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, military people, man. Like, everyone watches movies and they're like, that's so fake. Yeah. Or that would never happen. Or, you know, I mean, I just watched it as a movie and it was, I mean, it's a movie. I don't know who it's based on. But, I mean, I've never really done anything like that. Like, the bomb suit. I don't. You know what it's like to kind of work in that, but I never did Iraq, and that was based more on like on the Iraq experience, which I never did, so I couldn't speak intelligently to it.
Right.
I know you can't lift up mortars with connected by deck cord with one hand, or whatever they were. I forget what they were. They're 155s or whatever. But I mean, it was a movie. It was a good movie.
Right, you know? As a movie, it was entertaining. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the homecoming stuff at the end was well done. You know? So, yeah, it was a well-done movie.
Right. So, you know, recently in Syria, there was an EOD tech who was killed by the name of Scott Dayton.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously the details of surrounding his death wasn't released. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as an EOD tech, you know, the job itself is highly dangerous, and, you know, just in training, like, you know, if a bomb is, someone finds an IED or, you know, some kind of munition, everyone backs up and your job is to go in and try and render that safe. What is that like, for you guys?
I mean, that's what we train to do. It's what you want to do. I think most of us, but I mean, the situations there, it's all such a gray area. I mean, there's so many things that you train with, and a little variable here or a little variable there, and the situation has changed, and your personality comes into it. Each EOD tech is going to have a different personality. They're going to have things that like their go-to skills, or you know what I mean. Like any human being, you're going to have those skills and those differences and approaches. So it's so hard to know how you're going to react until it just kind of happens. Right. You know, that's what I try to tell the guys. And it's so difficult. We drill and we drill and we drill. And, you know, I try to tell them it's so hard to simulate those things or simulate, like, you know, how are you going to react when someone steps on an IED and you have to go get them. What are you going to do and all that stuff? So,
right.
Yeah, it's tricky.
I guess it's different from like a firefight, because in a firefight, you know, you're able to fire your weapon, and you know, you use all your training and skills to maneuver and try and make it do that. But you know, when you're dealing with an IED on the side of the road, it's like completely different, because you know, maybe someone's watching from afar and you know, they press the button. It's out of your control, you know. So now, like, I know I know you didn't go to Iraq, but there was a point in Iraq where the Iranians got involved and they were helping build it, or they were putting together these IEDs themselves, and they were really damaging coalition forces. I believe it was mostly seen in southern Iraq. So you say like the EOD community kind of and mission kind of changed, you know, obviously as the wars went on.
Sure.
Is there, in your opinion, in terms of like, you know, armored vehicles and stuff like that, is there like 100%, because like let's say an ODA, right? They'll go out in their vehicles. Some vehicles aren't very armored, some are.
Right.
And this is something I've always wondered. Wouldn't it make sense to just have all these vehicles armored? Like, is there a reason why that isn't kind of done on a more grand scale? Or maybe it is. I'm not sure.
I mean, I don't know. That's like probably way higher ups. But I mean, there's obviously always advantages to different things. There's maneuverability. You know, how, you know, if we need to get off road, what are we going to use? You know, can you get a JIRV? No, you can't drive. JIRVs weren't even, you know, in my opinion, really made for Afghanistan. You know, we drive those around. I mean, they had a very hard time, you know, getting anywhere off any road. So there were, you know, there are pros and cons to everything, and there's risk to everything, you know, to any kind of vehicle. So you just weigh, I think those guys, whoever we're enabling, whatever unit we're with, they're going to weigh those pros and cons, and they're going to make their decision. And it's our job to, you know, make our recommendations from an EOD perspective and or an IED threat perspective, and give those recommendations, and they can take them or leave them. And, you know, we just got to make sure that we do our best to keep them safe. I've worked in, you know, I've worked out of a JIRV. I've worked on, you know, ATVs, and, you know, a lot of my missions were helo inserts and walking around. So the majority of my time in Afghanistan was walking around.
Okay. So not so much as like driving up and down the roads in a Humvee or something like that.
No, most of mine were in helo. Most of them, you know, two out of my three deployments, the majority of them were helo missions.
So I guess that's safer in terms of, you know, the IED threat itself.
No, I mean, not when you're landing. And I mean, if you're going to infill through Panjway and Kandahar, right, and you're walking around Panjway, then, you know, it's... You've got to definitely have your head on right, and, you know, your mission planning right, and you know, Helmand and Kandahar, it was, and especially, you know, the Horn and Panjway, it was like the NFL of IEDs. You know, that's how I looked at it. I was like, man, I would not want to go anywhere else. This is great.
the Army EOD tech who I had on, he
was in Panjway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked about that.
Yeah, and I know. I've also had on retired Special Forces Major Rusty Bradley. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
No.
So he spent a lot of time in that area, and he wrote a pretty good book about one of his deployments there. And, you know, he kind of shined some light on like how it worked in terms of fighters kind of traveling through that area and everything like that. And hey, Damien, so can you would you be able to share a story, maybe of a deployment or something, with the audience, just to kind of give them a bit of an insight to what it's like in your world?
Yeah, sure. I'll go back to my first deployment because I made a lot of mistakes on that one. So that deployment was taught a lot, taught me a lot at least. So we were there. We were my platoon was supporting SOTF South, so they were supporting third group was the SOTF, and it was third group and seventh group that were third special forces and seventh special forces group that was down there. I was with an ODA from 7th Group, and we were doing basically clearing Panjoway, doing village clearances in Panjoway at the time. So we were infilling on helos, kind of clearing villages for VSOs that came later. I'm sure you know what those are. You've heard about those. So we were infilling at night, and we had gotten our target building, and we had done a breach that didn't really work. I had set a wall breach that wasn't really successful, and at that point you're in a rush. At that time, so the Afghans, we had some engineers, and they were kind of like Afghan commando. We were a commando unit with engineers, and they were kind of the guys that were like little EOD techs. Like we worked with them on IEDs and stuff like that. So it was only my second mission with them. And they said that the commandos said they wanted to go through the doorway, and I said, okay, can we, it wasn't my favorite thing, but I said okay. And they cleared the doorway, and I went up and I knelt on in front of the doorway, and I was making sure there weren't IEDs. I was like doing a secondary clearance of it, and the ground was very hard. I didn't see any sign of an IED in that spot. So we made entry, and after we made entry, there was an explosion in that doorway, and the last two Afghans that had come through had blown up, had initiated an IED. And in that kind of chaos, he was brought inside. He had lost three limbs, one of the Afghans, and the other one was had some blast injuries. So we had to medevac him and treat his injuries and try to get him out of there. And now, so the medevac bird is called in, and the bird comes in, and there's another IED goes off underneath that helo as it's flying in
Oh,
somehow.
wow.
Either the rotor wash hit a trip line. I believe at that time another member of one of the other elements, one of the ODA guys, had tripped a trip line, but it had not initiated. It hadn't gone off. The charge hadn't blown up. So it was pretty chaotic at that time. There was not much movement as far as I now. I only remember pieces of this kind of. I don't remember the whole thing super well. But we were able to somehow get a hoist dropped into our compound, and we tried to get that Afghan out in time, but he didn't make it. So we did our finish the mission, and we had to bring the body out when we exfilled. And come daybreak, we had all collapsed down, and I went and did a post blast analysis of that IED strike, and that blast seat was right where I was kneeling.
Wow.
So I didn't know how I didn't function it, or I have no idea how I did not function that. None of us tripped it, but it taught me a lot. It was a huge mistake, I felt, on my part. Obviously, I was very new as an EOD tech still. I had never been to war, and that was like my 6th week there, I think. And I mean, I saw it as a mistake, and it changed. A lot of things happened on that mission that changed how I did my job in the future. I never wanted any Afghan in front of me ever again. Like, not offense to them, but I felt that I owed it to them to go in front most, you know, as much as I could for that reason, you know, because it didn't seem right all the time. So yeah, it was it's one that I use when I'm teaching a lot, and it's a mission that I've gone over, you know, lots of times in my head, and how I could have done that differently. How could I have found that? Lots of things. I mean, there's lots of tactical things that you could have done different, but I didn't really know enough. And had I been the EOD tech I was on my third deployment, I think it would have gone much differently, but, it taught me a lot, and, you know, it happened early on. And, I mean, that's Panjway, you know, that was, not uncommon in that area.
Right. But you know, it's almost weird to say this, like to say what's good about something like that, but mm-hmm. obviously, you know, when we make mistakes in life anywhere, you know, the best thing you can do is to learn from them, especially in a job like that, you know. And mm-hmm. what I think is obviously there's benefits to war in terms of learning and the experiences you go through. Like you said, on your third rotation, things probably would have gone differently in that situation. And on one of the benefits of it is now the guys that you're teaching now, they can soak that up and potentially avoid a potential mistake because they had you there to teach them, like, hey, look, this happened. And, you know, maybe this is the best way to go about it, or that's the best way, you know.
Right.
So, you know, obviously, to say that there's good things coming out of war, mm-hmm. it, to some people, it probably doesn't sit too well. But, you know, kind of crazy to say it, but at the end of the day, that is the reality, you know, and
right.
Unfortunately, some of those lessons learned are learned in blood, you know, so.
Absolutely.
It sucks for the guys who have to lose their life or lose some limbs. And I know blast wounds are pretty serious, you know.
Mm-hmm. They're crazy.
Yeah. And do you guys go through like medical training, like bleeding control and stuff like that?
Yeah, we go through all that. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, I think.
But until you see it, you know, until you see that, what, because every IED, you know, how it's initiated, how, you know, did the guy kneel on it? I had someone kneel on one on my last deployment. You know, that was my second IED strike in the first 6 weeks. So they're all different, you know, and to see what that does to someone's body, it's crazy.
Yeah, it just destroys
it's
people.
Crazy. And just like it obliterates, like, but yeah, it's weird. It's like weird to put tourniquets on nothing, on, you know, right. there's nothing there. So it teaches, yeah, you learn quick. And the more, I hate to say this, but, you know, the more situations you're in like that, the you know, sadly, the better you get at dealing with it.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And I know in this global war on terror, since it's begun, more guys are surviving battlefield wounds. So there are more,
right.
you know, more guys who are missing two legs or missing one leg and an arm.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate, but there's a mission that has to get done, you know? So.
Oh yeah. I have a couple of good guys from my unit that, one was a triple amputee, and one was a double amputee from my last, he was on my last platoon, and, they're amazing guys. Like, they're real role model. I mean, you know, they're really people to look up to, you know, and, the 20, you know, 20 something surgeries, you know what I mean? Just to, and, you know, and they're doing well. So it's, those people are huge motivations.
Yeah. I know a couple of guys.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
Similar, you know, situations. And one guy I know is, his name is Jared Bullock. He's a former Special Forces guy, and he was riding in a Humvee, if I'm not mistaken. I had him on the podcast, but like early in the podcast. So, you know, he lost, arm and a leg, and he's really one of the most positive guys I know, you know, and it's really inspiring to see it because, you know, people get down on themselves. So, you know, whatever, you know, life happens.
Right.
But then go on Instagram and you check out Jared's profile and you're just like, what the fuck am I complaining about?
Right.
So yeah, it's all good stuff. So
yeah, sure.
So like when you guys, so like you said, you went back and kind of did a blast analysis.
Mm-hmm.
When you're going through that process, mm-hmm. can you like learn or have an idea of how things were put together from that? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things. You're just basically like a, you know, you're like a, you're just basically a, what I would assume like a detective would be on a, or any kind of, you know, person would be on a crime scene, and you're just trying to get whatever you can out of there. You know, and they're all different. So you're going to get some things from some and you won't get other things, you know, from others. I was just like, holy shit. I was kneeling right there. That's crazy. Yeah.
So what was it? Was it like a, was there a tripwire or how was that specific?
It was actually hard to know, what it was. I think it was deemed, if I remember right, to be like a pressure plate. There wasn't a whole lot of evidence to collect on that one.
All right. Well, I guess that would be kind of difficult, right? After the fact.
Well, sometimes, I mean, they'll leave stuff behind, you know, if it doesn't blow all the way, or if it's, you know, if the homemade explosive isn't made well, and, you know, you'll have more evidence left over maybe, but that one was a big one. It went.
Yeah. So on the podcast for a previous episode, I had a British paratrooper by the name of Stu Pearson, and he was in southern Afghanistan. They were, I believe, on overwatch for this dam that was being put together called the Kajandi Dam.
And, yep.
And he didn't step on an ID initially. One of the other guys did in his unit. And, you know, it turns out they were in what they call a legacy minefield, like mines that were left behind by the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really kind of a horrible situation because all these guys are like, you know, they're trying to help get this one guy out. Another guy steps on an IED. You know, they're probing. You know, there's like techniques from moving through. And he stepped on one, and then a medevac bird came in, and from the downdraft, it set off another one. Like, it was just a really bad situation.
That's what happened. Yeah, with us, like the rotor wash pressure had set off another trip line. So
So I guess in that situation, the way to do it would be to stay a certain height out and drop. I guess they call it a wench, or that's what he was calling it. That's what the Brits call it.
Yeah, you can. No, so we do like a hoist. Oh, and just like when you see the at sea rescues or, you know, all that stuff. And with that has its own, you know, issues that you have to deal with that as well. But yeah, there really wasn't much they could have done. I mean, you know, as far as flying higher, lower, you know, how tight are those trip lines? You know what I mean? Like the things in Afghanistan, they were so rudimentary, they just worked.
Right, like really basic but effective.
Super basic, but it worked.
So now at the point where you're at in your career, now you're you're an instructor at the school.
No, I'm an instructor. We have like an evaluation unit, so I'm finishing up my time there.
Okay, and are you going to do your 20, or are you getting out before then?
I don't know yet. I'm unsure.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sure yet. So it's kind of like a tricky time deciding what to do next.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, I guess also with the, you know, the transition that's taking place in the White House and, you know, policy might change, or I'm sure it will actually, in terms of, you know, how we're going to move forward with this, you know, ISIS situation and Syria, you know?
Right. Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, policies, those are, I'm sure they're going to change in some way. Everyone likes to, well, you know, kind of put their spin on things, or the new president, the president-elect will have his cabinet, and they'll do their thing.
Right. So Damien, I know, you know, spending the amount of time that you've been in EOD, you know, like you said, you had some guys who lost legs and limbs, and I'm sure you've lost some of your brothers in combat. Is anyone you wanted to talk about? Kind of like give a tribute.
There's a lot. It's tough. We just lost Jason Finan in October from my unit, my mobile unit 3. So that hit everybody very hard. He was definitely, in my opinion, the best. I mean, EOD tech I had ever been, I had been around. He graduated EOD school a little bit ahead of me and then went to Mobile Unit 3. I went there later. And he was, I can't think of anyone more highly regarded than him in our field and just a good man. He just came through training recently before he deployed and we were talking and had an incredible amount of respect for him. I cannot say enough good things about him. He's a great, just human being, Nice. Way better EOD tech than me. And I remember telling the guys in my division, hey, before he came through with this platoon, I said, he's going to come through and when he finishes, you'll say that was the best EOD tech that ever came through. And they all agreed. Wow. So it was a huge loss. They're all like huge, but I remember getting the phone call and I just could not, we're still reeling it from that, from all of them. But, and there was a big one. In January 2nd, 2012, we lost Chad Reglin and he was on my first platoon, to Afghanistan together. He had been to Iraq and then we went to Afghanistan together in August of 2010. We'd come home from that one and then he had volunteered to go right back. So he was with, an ODA from fifth group in Helmand and he was killed in January 2nd, 2012. And that still is very hard. And, he was just such a good kid. It's really hard. He was so young and he was just a great kid and like had a real, everything with these guys, like the through line is kind of the same. It sounds redundant, but he was extremely humble. They were aggressive without being reckless and they did the job like for the right reasons. They were the first ones to volunteer to go. Even JJ came off short duty early to take the team he was just on, and they don't have to do that. And I understand nobody has to do anything, but in our field, at that unit, it was like when something went down, when there was an opening, then who was the first person to run up to that office and say, send me now. You wanted to be that person.
Right.
And those were the two guys. Those two guys were ones that everyone wanted on the team. And then, we lost Lieutenant Mosco in 2012, as well. And, Sean Carson later on in 2012, from Molina 3. And, I could go on. On my last deployment, we lost our TAC EW. So it was Christian Pike. He was, attached to the SEAL team as well. He was, he was a CTT. Mm-hmm. He was killed in a firefight that we were in. And he was, I am not like a friendly person on deployment. I'm not like, I don't laugh a lot or, but he's, and he was always like the opposite. Like he loved his job. And it's like it's always like the best people. It's just like we lose the best people. Mark Forrester was a CCT that I worked with for a really short time on the beginning in 2012. He was a CCT and he was killed.
Yeah, I read about him. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. He was I was originally at FOB Cobra in a Rizgon before I went to do the commando mission. And he actually, like my first IED strike, he was the one that tried to sprint it to the guy before I could even get there. On that same day, another EOD tech from our unit that was on that the ODA captain had initiated an IED and lost his legs, and he had gone to clear him and saved his life. So, or helped, assisted in saving his life. And then Calvin Harrison, that same day Mark was killed. Calvin was an 18 Delta with that ODA 7212.
Oh, he was killed in the same situation.
The same gunfight. Yeah. And he was awesome. He like, you know, again, I was only at that site for about a month and a half, but those guys, you know, they were great. Pat Feeks was a SEAL. He was killed the same helicopter that Sean Carson was shot down on. Pat Feeks was on him. I'd worked on a few missions, you know, with him up in northern Afghanistan earlier that year. He was a SEAL the same time that Dave Warson was killed. I mean, you cross paths with a lot of these people, you know, you shake hands with them before missions, and then you move on to other sites. And it's just, it's funny. Like, they were all great people, you know, like much better than me in my job. They were all much better than I was. I don't even know being, I mean, you know, you come home and it's just, you realize you're just lucky to be home, you know?
It's crazy because, you know, like you said, you know, you went through that spot right where the IED was.
And yeah.
The guy behind you walks through and it goes off, you know, it's like, yeah. it's so crazy how that works, you know? And
yeah, it's nuts.
You could be standing in a spot. You move, the next guy comes right in and he gets shot, you know, and he gets killed.
It's just, man, bullets do weird things, you know, they fly in weird directions and bounce off shit and, you know, and IEDs, you know, don't go off sometimes and, you know, you're lucky, but, yeah. And, I think we always try to honor them, you know, luckily like Chad's family was really gracious and allowed me to make some memorial t-shirts for him.
Oh, nice.
So I'd done that, made some coins for him, for them. And, he just came, you know, these people's families, you know, I don't know how you could ever get over this, you know, so losing your family member. So,
right.
We just really do everything for them to honor them. Everything that, you know, is really to honor the guys that we lost.
Well, you know, it's interesting, like, you know, when you lose somebody, you, at least for me, you know, in my experiences, you know, you lose somebody and I feel like you have to, you know, like I use that as my motivation, you know, like to, you know, to work hard every day and try and do my best, you know, and honor the memory of, you know, people that I lost, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. To like, it's almost like there's pressure to like, I need to do something good with my life.
Right. Like they're watching you, you know, like,
yeah. Yeah. I don't really believe in any of this, but so the t-shirts that I made for just another little anecdote, like a t-shirt that I had with Chad on the back of them, I wore it on every mission on my third deployment. And, it was funny cause I was back living in the same room that he lived in our first deployment. So it was kind of odd how it like had come full circle. And, the one mission that I did not wear his t-shirt was when the Afghan stepped on the IED on the last deployment. And so I remember we got home and I looked and I said, okay, man, I get it.
I'll wear your shirt, bro.
Yeah. But, everything, you know, was an honor. It was to honor at that point was to honor, you know, those guys that we lost up to that point.
Right. And so now, like, you know, switching back over to like the actual job itself, you know, obviously for any unit, special ops or infantry, you know, guys, like we were talking about before, you learn these hard lessons through, in blood, right?
Right.
You know, do things this way, enter the room this way.
Right.
Has there been improvements in that area for EOD as a whole from the beginning of the GWAT to where we're at now?
Oh, absolutely. I think things have changed immensely. And we, you know, there's been some incredible people that I've been able to learn, you know, from, guys that have done, you know, massive amounts of IEDs that I could never do. So, and deployments and all that. So, We've been lucky, I think, to have some people that are very open-minded, flexible, you know, and learning new tactics to kind of get us home and get the guys home. And because if you don't stay flexible in this, I mean, things change all the time. Every deploy, you know, this man, every 3 months things change. Or, you know, if I went back 3 months after I came home, I treated it as like a whole new war. Not like I knew what was going to be going on.
Right.
You know, because it's everything's changing so fast. And you know, it's just a matter of time. You know, it felt like a matter of time before you were going to get bit, you know, by an IED at some point. You know? But yeah, we're always trying to push, you know, the limits and find new ways to do things. You know, my whole thing is I think your mind is always the best, you know. Not to be hokey, but I think it's better than any robot or any tool or metal detector.
Right. You
know, like your that like battlefield IQ this is important.
Right. Absolutely. And that, you know, that could transition over into kind of anything in life, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it doesn't take much. Like, you know, there are certain things like it's just out of your control, you know? You know, you're going in there with the, you know, the best military on the planet,
mm-hmm.
you know, against guys who may not be able to read or write, but they can still affect the battlefield. You know, because we're all human. Like, it, you know, you can be, you know, Navy SEAL, Green Beret, whatever you want, EOD yeah. tech.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, we're still human, you know. So,
yeah.
You know,
you're just flesh and blood, you know.
Right. Like you can't, you know, you can't get hit by a fucking sniper with a rifle. Bounce off you, you know, so
nope. And I just want to say, like, I you know, but I mean, while I have a second, I just wanted to really like just thank all the man, because you know, there's like all through Panjwa and all through Afghanistan and Helmand, there's Marines and like these like 11 Bravos,
yeah,
or all these infantry units, like walking around Panjwa every day for like a year. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And I don't ever really need to thank them, but and guys, you know, like I talk about the stuff and you know, who is your brotherhood and all that stuff, and that's my like who it doesn't matter like what your job is. If you were walking around that country, you know, like damn, you know, there's certain areas, you know. It does something to you. You know, it definitely, you have a new appreciation for things. Like I'll never forget this. I was sitting in Chow Hall in Kandahar. And I had like this really horrible tattoo on my hand of the MGRS. That's Panjwa, like the first five of that MGRS. Hmm. And, it's hard to read because it got all blown out and, but I was sitting there eating and this guy walks up to me, this sergeant, this 11 Bravo guy, and he's like, Panjwa, man. And I was like, and he's just like, that place is no joke. And I was like, no. I just shook my head, I didn't say anything. You know?
Yeah.
And that's really kind of like that, you know what I mean? Like those are the people that I feel like tied to, you know?
Yeah, and you know, I'm glad you said that because, you know, and with the whole like, you know, online military community, mm-hmm. and obviously with the kind of spotlighting that soft units get, you know,
yeah, it's crazy.
You know, like people like overlook the infantry.
They always do. They know? Always, yeah. And I don't. I'm not. You know, railing on media or a little bit.
Yeah,
I am in the public, yeah. But it's like. You know, you can be obsessed with like growing a beard or not. Who cares?
Right.
Like, it doesn't mean anything. IEDs didn't care if I had facial hair or not. Near to the bullets.
Right. And it's like, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, you could be the highest tiered, you know, soft operator. You know, you walk into an ambush, you're walking into an ambush, you know, it's just, yep. the same thing. So, you know,
with anything, it's like, you know, and it was just one of those things, like we had like a step count, like you could only take a certain amount of steps. And in Panjwa without stepping on something.
Really?
Well, that's what it seemed like. Like, you couldn't just walk around there. Like, you know, on the, like, my last deployment, I was like, there's no way I'm making it out of here, you know, with my limbs.
Right. I mean, and that's got to be crazy, like, for the mind, you know?
Yeah. I'm sure it leaves its mark, you know, but, yeah, I always try to thank those, you know, those guys, cause I do believe they get incredibly overlooked, with the kind of focus on soft stuff. And it's not like the special operations people's fault. I don't believe it's just,
right.
It's just the way it is with the movies, I think, now, and all the books and stuff like that. But I just like to thank those guys every like chance I get, because, you know, it sucked for them. You know, like, it sucked.
Yeah, and it's like typically like the soft rotations are shorter than the infantry.
Yeah, some of them it seems like. Yeah. My last one was 9 months with SEAL Team 5.
But that's kind of long.
And that was a long one. Yeah, yeah, I think it was like 9. It felt like 9. Maybe it was 8, but I think it was 9.
Well, I think the SEAL teams and the ODAs deploy for a decent chunk in comparison, mm-hmm, to like some of the other soft units.
Sure. Yeah. 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 They do generally similar rotations, you know, and all the enablers. You know what I mean? Like the CCTs and, you know what I mean, the TACPs and, you know, all those dudes. You know, damn, I think the CCT on my with the first commando, I think that was his 8th deployment to Afghanistan.
Wow.
Something like that. Something insane. Like the Green Berets would come in, hey, how many deployments have you got? They're like 7. How many of you are like, oh, it's my first one? Yeah, yeah. You know? You feel like an idiot. They would ask me, so what do you think of, like, what are your tactics? I was like, hey, man, you've made it through 6 deployments here. What are you doing to not hit an IED?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, so... Okay, so now, you know, you're doing your instructor time. Mm-hmm. You know, not sure how you're going to close it out, but,
right,
you know, I just want to thank you for everything you've done, you know.
Oh, thank you, yeah.
You know, it's
my pleasure.
Yeah. So, yeah, man, so, you know, I just want to thank you for taking the time to come out on the podcast. You know, I think the audience is going to appreciate it. I don't think, you know, I think I'm at 57 episodes in.
Oh, right on. Nice, man.
So, and if, you know, there's other military podcasts, I don't think people get to hear from guys like you, too often.
Yeah.
And I know that.
Lucky for them.
Yeah. I know, like, you know, there's always like an element of people who kind of are against, you know, talking about any of this kind of stuff. And I get it, but at the same time, you know, the benefit that, you know, the conversation we're having on a kid who's going to be the next, you know, superstar EOD tech, mm-hmm, you know, there's no way to measure that, you know? And,
right,
you know, I know that people, you know, the younger generation, they listen, they, you know, they read as much as they can to try and soak all of it up before they go, right, in, you know? So there's a huge benefit to doing this, in my opinion, obviously. So,
cool.
You know, I just want to thank you again and, you know, thank you for your service.
Yeah. Thank you, man. Thanks for letting me talk about the guys that we lost and pay tribute to them. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, I always think that's incredibly important, you know, for several reasons. But, you know, I'm sure that their families would appreciate it, you know.
Cool. Thank you, man.
All right, brother.
Thanks, brother.
With the terrorist groups, various groups that we're fighting against in, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, you know, their preferred method of inflicting damage on Western troops is through improvised explosive devices or IEDs. And since this is their most successful way of attacking Western forces, the role of EOD technicians from the Navy, from the Army, and, you know, combat engineers as well, has never been more important. And what these guys do is a very, very dangerous job. I mean, you know, if there's a unit out on patrol and they spot what they believe is an IED, everyone backs away. And we're talking infantry fighting companies, special operations guys, you know, war fighters, everyone backs away. And then the EOD tech comes in and they try and figure out how can they render these munitions safe? So it's a very dangerous job. They've made tremendous sacrifices since the beginning of the global war on terror. And, you know, we should honor and respect these men. And I'm glad that Damien was open to talking about some of his fallen brothers and some of the guys from the different special operations communities that he's worked with who passed, as well as some of the infantry guys and grunts from the Marine Corps, you know, Army 11 Bravos, guys who kind of tend to get overlooked in today's kind of world where special operations forces are kind of the rock stars of the military. And, you know, I just think it's important that everyone gets their recognition, even though some people don't want it, you know, but, you know, I think he did an awesome job and I'm glad that he came on. And, you know, I really hope that, you know, everyone can take away some of these lessons, especially the young men and women who are going to take that step and join the military and serve our country. So, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, we're going to begin rolling out articles. The team of writers that have come together to write for the website are very experienced individuals from various backgrounds, special operations, infantry, government. So I think you guys are going to enjoy some of the content that's coming. When I first started the website, you know, way before the podcast, I was putting out a lot of articles, but I was doing it mainly by myself with some contributions from some of my friends, like two from Rona Tactics. And, you know, it was fun for me, but it's been a long time since I had written anything, but I'm working on some interesting stuff now. And yeah, so, you know, we're right. The holidays are right around the corner. I hope everyone has a safe and happy holidays. You know, for the people who are not surrounded by family, I just want you guys to know, if you listen to this, that we care about you. We appreciate you. For those of you who are overseas deployed, taking a fight to our enemies, we appreciate you. We care about you. We want you guys to come home safe. And, you know, with that, we'll close it out. Check out my website, www.globalrecon.net. My Facebook account is FB Recon. My Instagram account is IG Recon. The second account is Black Ops Matter. I'm on Twitter at IG Recon. I'm on LinkedIn. Just search Global Recon. As always, I encourage you to subscribe, download, share the episodes with your friends and family. Check us out. We're on SoundCloud as well. Just search Global Recon Podcast. That way, we'll be able to continue to bring you high quality content. And I guarantee you guys are going to like what we got cooking up for the new year. And we'll see you guys in a couple of days with another episode. Peace.